Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News. Today we've got a very special guest, someone that I really admire. That's Jamison Lopp. He's working on Bitcoin, the Lightning Network. He's one of the co-founders of Casa, which you've probably heard. We're going to talk about everything that they do. So thanks for joining us today, Jamison.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, where do we get started? You do so much. I'm sure plenty of people already follow you on Twitter, but I guess I'd just love to get the quick background of what you were doing before you got into Bitcoin and sort of that path that led you to become that cypherpunk.
Sure. Computer scientist by trade. I was basically doing large-scale data analysis for online marketers. So actually the antithesis of what I do now. And perhaps that's what gave me a bit of perspective of how much data really flows around the internet and how much various organizations are collecting about people. Because I was helping organizations suck up data from emails and websites and basically correlate it all together and try to, you know, better help people target customers and sell stuff to them. So, you know, it was not something that I was ever particularly enthusiastic about. It just posed some interesting technical challenges and kept me busy until I got, the Bitcoin bug a number of years ago.
Yeah, I will mute my mic from time to time with that crying baby in the background the best I can, sure. Mate. That's the problem of being in isolation, I guess, at the moment. Plan B put out an interesting article recently about the changes of states of Bitcoin. And back in the day when Bitcoin was, you know, a bit of an experiment, and then it sort of had that payment network, and that's where a lot of the debate happens these days about, you know, is Bitcoin meant to be this digital cash versus it's become this store of gold? Now, I'm of the belief that you don't know what a technology is going to be best at doing when you make it 10 years on, and the world needs hard money, probably more than it needs a payment network at the moment. So I'd love to get your thoughts mm-hmm. on how that sort of changed.
Yeah, so actually just a few days ago, I published a blog post. And I mean, I've been writing blog posts ever since I got into the space. But, you know, with all the extra free time now, I think I've been ramping up the articles that I've been pumping out. And the article that I wrote, it was kind of different. Usually I write technical stuff, but this one was actually about memes. And I was essentially talking about mimetic theory and how that relates to the narratives of what Bitcoin is and how that evolves over time. And I think, you know, this is something you could have a whole hour-long episode about in and of itself, but essentially we're still discovering what the technology is and can do, what the limits of it are, and we're still discovering what the human consensus is for, like, what the most valuable attributes of the system are and how we are comfortable or uncomfortable with changing different aspects of the system based upon the trade-offs that result from that. And that's essentially what, like, a lot of this scaling debate stuff came down to. After years and years of arguing, I kind of boiled it down to a very simple trade-off, which is cost of creating a transaction versus cost of validating the entire system. And so that's where we ended up at kind of a fundamental philosophical impasse between different people and their own perspectives of what Bitcoin is and what trade-offs they were willing to make to the system, but based on what the properties they thought were, like, most valuable to the system.
Yeah, and for people at home, and I've spoken to Andreas about this as well, and my understanding is there's still a lot of scaling we can get, and everyone's in a rush. They want it to happen tomorrow, but there's still a lot of scaling and computer science that we can apply and get transaction counts up, even with the 1 megabyte size, let alone the Lightning Network, which I know you're really passionate about. So with those scaling techniques, a lot of those appear to be sort of 12, 24 months away. You know, are you got an interest in all of those, or are you more focused on the Lightning Network?
Yeah, that's actually another one of the memes that I mentioned in my article is, like, you know, it always seems like we're 12 to 24 months away from things. Or this, and this essentially, this is because software is never done, and because we, like I said, are still exploring sort of the edges of the possibilities of what can even be done with the system. And it's these trade-offs that we find ourselves constrained by that make the people like myself who are trying to build on top of the system more challenged. There are, like we said, different camps of philosophies around how we could change the system or how the system should change based on what we think it should do. And that was another one of the trade-offs, kind of as you mentioned, is some people were in more of a rush than others, who they wanted to see the system grow and they were willing to make certain trade-offs to try to see that happen faster, as opposed to other people who said, you know, we're willing to wait, we're willing to experience some pain and discomfort, some growing pains, if you will, due to the inflexible nature of trying to make certain changes at the low level. So, I mean, I'm very interested in seeing more scalability. I, like everyone else, want to see global adoption of the system, but ultimately, I don't want to trade off certain attributes, such as the cost of someone being able to audit the system themselves, just so that we can see more people get onboarded and start using the system faster.
Yeah, and to pick that apart a bit more, I think the what, say, BSV, for example, has done, they've ended up with, what, I'm not sure, maybe 100, 200 nodes, and they've got these huge blocks and the data, the storage space you require. So that's, I just want people at home, the beginners, to understand that, yeah, you can scale really quickly, but that's a massive trade-off. And the community has really decided that decentralization is so much more important than having these 100 super nodes, data centers, whatever you want to think of them as.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the fun part about all of this, is that we can argue about it until we're blue in the face, but no one can stop anyone else from creating their own version, you know, forking off, essentially trying a different path down this experiment. I mean, the whole thing has been an experiment since the beginning, and it's an open collaborative project where if people want to, they can try to remain, you know, within the consensus of the majority of folks and work within those constraints. Or if they get too frustrated, they may say, you know what, I'm going to leave. I'm going to try my own thing. And if that works, then it should have its own value and get its own set of users, et cetera. And they can compete in the free market, essentially.
100%. And I think we've seen over 100 forks if you actually go and have a look. But I think it's getting harder and harder for them to survive, particularly after they've had their halvings. And I also think that Bitcoin, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, it's almost impossible now to get a hard fork through. Do you think a lot of these upgrades are going to have to be soft forks, particularly the privacy-focused ones? That's going to be really hard to get through as Bitcoin's, I guess, matured and got its corporate aspects now.
Yeah, you know, privacy is going to be another one of the big things that I think people argue about after scalability. And that's because there are other trade-offs, again, at play. So, you know, there are other protocols out there, whether it's Monero with ring signature type privacy applications, or something like Zcash with zero-knowledge proofs. You know, these arguably have stronger privacy attributes than Bitcoin, but you once again make trade-offs. Most of the time, one of the biggest trade-offs that you make is scalability. These things tend to, you know, require more data, once again, more block space. But the deal breaker, I would say, that would prevent those strong privacy functions from getting into the Bitcoin protocol is auditability of the total supply. So if you get to a point where the reason you have better privacy is because you're able to completely obscure the values of the transactions, then often that means you can no longer sum up the total value of the money in the system. And, you know, the 21 million Bitcoin limit is one of those strong attributes that I think we can safely say is never going to change in Bitcoin.
Yeah, we have seen those instances, haven't we, where there's been bugs or, you know, you don't really know if there has been that inflation or something happened to the Zcashers and the Moneros and whatnot. Do you have any thoughts around that? Do you think there's someone out there that maybe got to mint a few extra here or there before they audited or changed those bugs?
I mean, really, it's a question of, you know, how many people could have possibly known about a given bug before it was found and patched, right? It seems unlikely, but the fact that you can't prove it one way or another should be enough to, I think, give people pause and you know, make them question, you know, what's really going on here.
Yeah. So getting into the Lightning Network, that's, you know, it started off with a flurry, it was growing month on month, and it sort of, it really has stalled, I'd say, in terms of the growth numbers, but I guess so have crypto markets. It tends to grow with the renewed interest and new users and whatnot. So how have you seen that? Have you been a little bit disappointed, or is it just that software takes time thing that you were saying before?
So I think during 2018, we saw amazing growth that far surpassed anyone's expectations. And then 2019 has been more subdued growth. So, you know, this is probably just another type of cycle that we're going to go through. On the technical side, there has been quite a bit of progress. And progress in terms of you know, both security and like finding security and privacy flaws that needed to be fixed at the protocol and implementation level, and also learning a lot about sort of the new economics of this network. And that is, I think, going to be one of the trickier things is, you know, we already had Bitcoin, which is this ongoing experiment. Nothing had really ever been done like this before 2009. And then you're building this completely new network on top of it that really no one has ever tried to build a network like this before. And so from like an economic and, you know, liquidity management standpoint, this is like game changing. No one has ever tread here before type of territory. You know, you're going to run into a lot of weird edge cases, you know, things that no one could have predicted until you actually start stressing the network. And so that is more of what we've been seeing, I think, through 2019, as more people were actually using this network for commerce, as more people were trying to run Lightning nodes, not just as hobbyists, but as actual enterprises. That's when you start learning a lot more because you've got real money on the line. And so people are going to start being more adversarial and, you know, trying to poke holes and find various issues and, you know, potentially, you know, get money for themselves. You know, a lot of these things, they are their own bug bounties, right? Is, you know, if you can find a bug in one of these protocols, you may be able to make yourself rich. So that's when you really start to harden these networks, because there's real incentive for people to find flaws in them.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you heard of the Wallet of Satoshi, the Australian, the guys that have made the Lightning wallet?
Yeah.
So most of our audience have had to play around with that, and that's probably the extent of their you know, experimentation with the Lightning Network. But as you say, in the past 12 months, we've seen some really cool, I think it's Strike, where you can do your payments from the fiat world through the Lightning Network. Andreas was talking about, you know, smart routing and whatnot. You mentioned the economics. I know that's something that people often criticize and say, you know, $1 million, you might make $50 or $500 a year. So yield wise, that's not very attractive. But Yeah, what are your thoughts on all that? I personally think that we're always going to have people that want to play around and support the network. The OGs and whatnot, they're going to run this sort of stuff. They don't need it necessarily to be economically viable to begin with. Or do you think that, yeah, long term, we're going to have so many people using that that you know those fees are going to make it economically viable?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is... it's always been something sort of akin to mining, right? Is that there are incentives at play that will essentially drive the cost down. It is, I would say, an even more competitive type of game than mining, because at least with mining, you have to go out, you have to acquire hardware, you have to... find cheap electricity. There's a fair amount of sort of like industrial and enterprise engineering type of stuff that can give some people more of an advantage when, you know, they're running things at scale. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Lightning, I would say the bar is even lower. All you really need is you have to have some Bitcoin. And then you have to have some technical ability to run the software. And then, so the question becomes, you know, where can you possibly get competitive advantages? And it seems to me like the majority of the competition over providing liquidity on the Lightning Network is going to come down to best understanding and managing, you know, the liquidity of these channels. And so it's almost going to become, I think, similar to a day trading type of game, right? Is where you're looking at all of these different flows of value, and you're trying to best optimize how your value is positioned within the network in order to capture as much flow as possible. And so, you know, it seems to me like it's basically going to come down to a numbers game, and the more technically sophisticated people who are able to write algorithms to figure out this stuff, they're going to be the ones that have the advantage and are going to be able to essentially make the most money. But, you know, because this, like I said, it doesn't really require much capital cost other than the actual Bitcoin themselves, I think that's going to result in it being like even more competitive than mining, for example, which is just going to drive the cost down. It's going to make the fees even lower, to the point that we're going to have to get to some threshold, which is probably going to be akin to I guess the risk that is being taken by the people that are operating these liquidity providers. And so I think there have been some economist types who have looked at it and said, well, it's going to be this sort of new interest rate, or, you know, what is the time value of money, right? And and there has been some speculation around what the actual time value of money is. I expect that will be, you know, extremely low in terms of like percentages of value.
Yeah. One of the things I was also reading about is the ability to break up those payments. I'm not sure if that has a specific name yet, but that liquidity, it won't all have to go through one node. If you want to send $100 over Lightning and there's not a path, you might be able to break it up into five lots of $20 as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. Atomic multipath payments. Yes. And of course this, you know, we're talking about really low-level technical stuff. Like, this is not something that the end user should even have to know is happening. It should all be happening under the hood. You know, you just press, you know, pay money, and the network, the implementations should figure out, you know, what is the optimal way for me to push the value through the network. And if I have to break it up into a dozen different paths, because that allows me to use smaller liquidity channels and therefore pay lower fees, then I'll do that.
100%. As you mentioned, you do require a bit of technical knowledge, and I guess that's why you started up Casa. So for those that don't know what Casa is, do you want to maybe talk about what it is and some of those products that you guys have?
Yeah, so the short version is that we're focused on helping people improve their personal sovereignty. And the first product that we put out a couple of years ago is essentially a self-custody solution. It is a multi-signature wallet, which means you have multiple sets of keys that it requires multiple authorizations, multiple sign-offs in order for a transaction to be created. What we tried to do is build the ultimate security model, which is, you know, safe against, of course, hackers, but even more importantly, safe against things like natural disasters and human error. It's in many cases, I think, when once people go down the path of being their own bank, they're actually more likely to screw up and lose their money than they are to have someone hack them or attack them and you know, take their Bitcoin from them. So we built out our security model, our threat model, and then we said, okay, well, how do we implement this in a way that doesn't require the user to be technically sophisticated? You know, we want it to be like a point and click type of thing. And so what we've done is we've leveraged the security available from various hardware providers like Trezor, Ledger, Coldcard, to have dedicated hardware devices that actually secure the private keys. And then we've built a really slick mobile app, native mobile app that helps you then manage these devices. So it's a very visual looking app. Essentially, you can visualize your key set, which is made up of these different hardware devices. And it's very easy for you to swap out hardware device, for example, if one gets lost or damaged or stolen or whatever. And the entire idea is that we build enough robustness into this setup where you have multiple sets of geographically distributed devices that it makes it essentially impossible for an attacker to get enough of these to steal your money, but also by simply, you know, following the instructions in the app and separating your keys, your devices, you are then safe against things like fire or flood or earthquake or whatever, you know, destroying enough devices simultaneously that you would, you know, lose ability to access your money. And also it gives you enough robustness that if you make a mistake, you know, if you accidentally destroy a device, you know, if your kid finds one of your devices at home and you know, throws in the toilet, you don't have to worry about that resulting in financial loss because you have robustness. You have additional backups, essentially, that you can use in case of disaster. And we're really just trying to make it easy for people. If you want to check it out, all you have to do is go to our website at keys.casa.
I'll link it all in the description below for people. But I remember first seeing that metal seed storage reviews that you were doing, mucking around with the flames and all that sort of thing. And I think sometimes people don't think about that when they've written down their words. Again, the other day, someone messaged us and said, I wrote down my 12 words in a random order. I thought that would be more secure. And I thought I'd be able to remember it at the time. But so what are some of the newer products you've got coming out? Because I think something that we need to do, and again, this does go against that cypherpunk movement a little bit, is the sort of the custodianship. There's a group of people that they've always bought their Apple shares, you know, the boomers, they've never had to hold their own shares or anything like that. So what are the sort of trade-offs and the multi-sig that you mentioned for people to have like an insurance or the backup situation?
Yeah, so, you know, this is one of the things that was challenging for us. You know, when we were thinking through that threat model, we actually got to a point where we realized, okay, you know, you buy a Trezor, you plug it in, and it tells you, you know, write down the seed phrase and keep it in a safe place. And as we were thinking through the ramifications of that, we basically decided this was asking too much of people, you know, to write down 12 or 24 words and keep them safe. There's just a mountain of technical and security knowledge that's kind of like the hidden part of the iceberg to all of that, which, as you just said, people can very easily screw up. Or even we've heard tales of, you know, someone passes away and they told their family, okay, you know, if anything happens to me, you know, here's the seed phrase to my wallet. And then the family like takes a photo of that and starts sending it around asking people what they should do with it, you know. And so, you know, the result of this is we actually eliminated seed phrases from our setup because we figured it's too much to ask of people. And instead, we tell people, you know, just let the hardware devices manage the seed phrases. You can just think of your security in a more, you know, physical sense of, this is the physical device that is part of your key set. If anything happens to it, we build in the functionality for you to essentially rotate that device out. And as we've been over the years, you know, learning more from our own user feedback, is we actually got to the point that we realized there was a lot of demand for an inheritance product. So, you know, we've built out a few different tiers of multi-sig setups over the years, but the most recent one is actually a 3 of 6 inheritance product, where the whole idea is that you have a threshold of these keys and these devices that are stored in locations that would be accessible given proof of death, essentially. So, you know, keep a key in a safety deposit box with beneficiary information on it. A key is kept with CASA, where we can sign a transaction given a death certificate. And then we added another key that would then be kept essentially by your attorney. Mm. And the attorney would have a software and instructions for, you know, how to add their signature to essentially disperse your funds to your heirs in the event of your death. Yeah. So these are the type of things that we end up spending a lot of time thinking through all the edge cases, and then trying to build software that makes it extremely simple for people to go through these fairly complex processes.
Yeah. So what were some of the edge cases or the game theory aspects? You know, you get the dodgy lawyer and he goes and gets the deposit box, or what happens if CASA get hacked or go broke? What are all those situations for the recovery?
Yeah, and you really have to think adversarially about it. And, you know, this is why if you go to our website, we have a link that says how it works. And that goes to our threat model that we developed for our original setup. And that is like 40 pages of information around like everything that we thought could potentially ever go wrong and how to mitigate against every one of those threats. And so, you know, we don't have enough time to talk about everything that could go wrong. And I don't like, you know, being a fear monger, because, you know, a lot of these things are edge cases, though other things do happen more often. You know, like it's actually not that uncommon for someone to have, you know, a house fire at some point in their lives, for example. So the short version is that essentially our goal is to eliminate single points of failure. So like you said, you don't want to trust the lawyer. You don't want to trust the bank. You have to assume that at any point in time, anything could be compromised. Any one entity, any one piece of software, any one physical location. You have to say, okay, what happens if this thing stops working, or if this thing turns on me and, you know, tries to start colluding and steal my money, right? Yeah. And so, you know, that's why we believe that the best way you can get robustness against all of these different events are it's essentially through decentralization, right? You're distributing your risk across multiple different pieces of hardware, software, physical locations. It's by using a diversity of different storage mechanisms that you then ensure that like no single type of failure will affect many of them.
Yeah, I know another thing that's been spoken about is like geolocation. So my device will only work if I'm in, you know, Tasmania where I live, for example. Do you guys have any like physical locations, or is geolocation something else that you've played around with?
So we've certainly thought about sort of geofencing, as it were. The problem with that is twofold. One is that geofencing essentially requires that you use IP mapping software to say, okay, you know, this IP address is in this location, and that will fail against any even semi-sophisticated attacker. They'll just use a VPN or Tor or something that will use an IP somewhere else. Or, you know, you can target where you want your IP to be with many different VPNs. And the other issue is that our software itself is not necessarily the most secure part of our setup, because we're using the Bitcoin protocol. We're using standards within Bitcoin for how to do multi-signature transactions. And we have to assume that if a sophisticated attacker wanted to, they don't even have to use the Casa software. And this is a feature, because we don't want Casa and our software and our servers to be a single point of failure. Therefore, it's possible to use completely different wallet software to recreate your wallet and spend from it. Therefore, like any specific security functions that we would put into the Casa software could be routed around just by using other wallet software to reconstitute your wallet.
For sure. So just quickly, what is like a real low end for just the basic person that doesn't want to store it themselves versus someone with millions of dollars? And what are the storage costs? I imagine it's sort of less than or similar to storing physical gold and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So there are, of course, different tiers of security and storage that someone can use. If you're going into self-custody, you know, you can download any number of wallets for free, even just like on your phone, and, you know, withdraw from whatever exchange you purchased at. And that costs almost nothing. But you're also exposing yourself to a ton of different risks. Really, I would say the first good option that someone can do is spend $100, buy one of these hardware devices like a Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card. Really, Cold Card is more advanced usage. Trezor is probably one of the most user-friendly. And withdraw your money to, you know, that wallet, that hardware device, and it's managing your keys and protecting you from hackers, essentially, by making sure that your keys are not on an internet-connected device. This is a great step forward in security, but you still have issues with robustness. You still have the single point of failure, the single key, essentially, that could be lost to any number of reasons. So then the question is, you know, how do you take another step forward? Well, that's when you get into multi-sig. We have a very simple 2 out of 3 multi-sig service where you can actually try it for free. We're charging $10 a month for like ongoing usage of it. We consider this to be something that makes sense for really anyone who has more than probably $1,000 worth of Bitcoin. Yeah. To take this next step. Once you start going up, you know, more orders of magnitude, if you have more than $100,000 of Bitcoin, you probably want to increase the level of robustness and have more than just 3 key sets. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, like, we have a tier that is more geared towards that with 3 of 5. And then once you start getting into the like $1 million plus territory, that's when we start talking about like 3 of 6 or even higher potentially inheritance solutions having even higher levels of robustness.
Fantastic. Yeah, I was checking all those out on the website, and I'll link that all down below as well, guys. Finally, I want to look back to the Lightning Network and privacy with all this happening. I believe some of these upgrades are going to make it a lot more private rather than the on-chain, you know, opening a channel and whatnot. Do you want to talk about that? And again, once you're in the Lightning Network, I think some people don't realize that that itself can be very private, or there may be that big node that's watching everything you do. So where's that sort of technology at the moment?
Yeah, you know, this is an evolving landscape as well. There have been a couple of different research papers that have been showing places where the privacy could be improved in the Lightning Network. I mean, it's more private by default simply because you are no longer globally broadcasting your transaction to everybody on the network. Mm-hmm. That's the first step. Then the one of the next steps that you can do is not publicly broadcast your channels, and you can have private channels that are connected to other nodes on the network. So the only other nodes that know about that channel are the ones you're directly connected to. Additional privacy is kind of built into the routing around how the payments actually get pushed through the network, and that uses some technology that's similar to Tor, this onion technology. But, you know, it's not necessarily perfect. You know, there are ways that certain adversaries can try to probe the network, for example. That's kind of where I think the forefront of this privacy research is happening right now is, you know, if you want to be able to send money through the network, you have to somehow be able to test whether or not you can send money to a certain destination. And that ability to test the ability to send money through various paths on the network can potentially result in data leaks. But that's starting to get, you know, a lot more sophisticated and technical about, you know, what is currently possible with the protocol. And these are the type of things that I think will continue to be tested and then hardened as appropriate as people, you know, find flaws and determine things that need to be improved.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about that, it sort of reminds me of the concept of like a sonar or a radar where you're putting out maybe even fractions of a Satoshi and just seeing who's doing what as it comes back to you. And I think, again, some people don't realize you can break up a Satoshi on the Lightning Network. Something I've always wondered about is how does that actually work if you go to settle on chain? You know, does it? I guess it always has to round down. It can't give you something that you don't quite have yet. Or how does that work?
Yeah. It gets lost essentially, and you know, it can even get more sophisticated than that, right? Because the cost of closing a channel on chain is going to have fees associated with it. So it's even more than just the sub-Satoshi issue is that. For example, if you're opening a Lightning channel and then you're only sending a payment for a few Satoshis or maybe 100 Satoshis, then it might be completely pointless if you then only send the one payment and then close the channel because you're going to end up paying more in fees than you saved. And so the whole point of Lightning Network is to keep these channels open as long as possible and reuse them as many times as possible in order to avoid having to settle on the blockchain. You know, that's where the real efficiency is avoiding touching the blockchain due to the cost associated with it.
Yeah. I remember reading a lot about the internet in the early days and how some aspects of the Bitcoin protocol are very similar. And these days there's layers of the internet that's routing enormous amounts of information, but it's only, you know, kilobytes. And so when people say, oh, how could Bitcoin ever become this global network if there's 1 megabyte block every 10 minutes? The hope is, as we said, 12 to 24 months away, that we can get these improvements. And do you think that that's a good sort of analogy and Bitcoin is just going to be this network? There's routing going everywhere. It's very efficient. And then we have the Lightning Network off to the side for microtransactions. That's the way it's going to play out in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, as a computer scientist, you know, this layered model is the same way the internet was built. You know, it's not a perfect metaphor, mainly because, you know, layer zero of the internet is just Ethernet, the wires, essentially, that we're pushing the signals through.
Yeah.
And, you know, the blockchain would also be considered sort of layer zero. But as we're scaling up, you know, it's like I mentioned with these liquidity issues, the way that, you know, traditional bandwidth on the internet has worked, it's generally you've got a two-way street, and yes, there's a cap on like how much data you can send. Usually it's, at least at the enterprise level, it's the same amount of data both ways, you know, if it's a fiber optic cable or whatever. We're more constrained when we're building these layers on top of Bitcoin, because we now have a more complicated amount of logic that has to go into, you know, how is the data being pushed back and forth, because it's not just that we have a single like cap on the throughput. It's that we're actually literally like pushing value one way or another. It's not a simple two-way street like we have with you know, low-level internet hardware.
Yeah, as in there's lots of information all propagating around. People are at different stages. Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah. So, you know, with the way that information flows through the internet, there is a similar type of you know, routing that happens where you might try different ways to route to a single location, and if one doesn't work, then it'll just try a different one. But the routing itself does not have it doesn't have the same limitations around like speed and value. I would say even a dumber protocol than what we have on Lightning, because it's just trying to send data. It doesn't really care about the like the bandwidth of what's going on at the layer below it. But if you're trying to route the value on the Lightning network, it's not as simple as, oh, I can't reach the destination. You might still be able to, you know, talk to the person at the other destination, but you might just not be able to push the value that you want in that direction due to the state of a specific channel. So, you know, it's just more complicated, you know, at the routing layer than I would say even the internet itself is.
For sure, yeah. I'm not a real technical person, so that's where I do enjoy learning about this stuff as well. Other networks we've had, Liquid has become a little bit more popular. I remember hearing at one stage there was a large percentage of exchanges, you know, even sending between each other, taking up that on-chain space. We've seen some tokens start to get issued on there, which is seen some interesting Twitter debates between the maximalists about tokens on the Lightning network and whatnot. So, yeah, do you have any thoughts around Liquid? Is that going to solve problems and there are good applications of that? Or is it something that's just very basic for those exchanges to send liquidity?
Yeah, so, I mean, theoretically, it could help a lot. I mean, I also think, and I actually gave a whole talk about last year, why I think it's incredibly important for us to get exchanges onboarded to the Lightning network due to liquidity issues. The ability to have a circular economy, that means that we'll have to have easy ways to basically get on-ramps and off-ramps to both fiat and on-chain Bitcoin, and like the exchanges are best suited for that. Liquid is interesting. You know, it does seem to be picking up adoption. I don't even remember the last time I logged into an exchange though. So it's not clear to me what the exchanges have done to expose Liquid to the users, or if they're doing much of this integration kind of behind the scenes.
Pretty much all behind the scenes, yeah.
But, I mean, there is, last I saw, good reason to believe that somewhere around half, if not more than half, of the on-chain Bitcoin transactions that are occurring are going to and from exchanges. And in many cases, going from one exchange to another exchange and back and forth and back and forth. I also discussed that in my talk last year of, you know, this is extremely wasteful in terms of block space, because in many cases, if these exchanges had their own like Lightning Network paths to each other, for example, then the flows would generally cancel out and many of these Bitcoin transactions would not even have to happen. You'd just be pushing the value back and forth in a Lightning channel. And so, you know, Liquid can do a similar type of thing. It's just instead of offloading it to a Lightning channel, you're offloading it to this second, you know, side chain. And, you know, this is kind of goes back to, I guess, the very beginning of what I was saying of with more patience, we can look around, we can see the constraints of the system. And even though it can be more frustrating, the engineers like myself who are looking at the way the system is used can find obvious points where it is being used inefficiently and try to build solutions that guide people into best practices of, you know, using the system, using these scarce resources more efficiently. And, you know, that is good for adoption and scalability in general. There are a number of different ways to approach scalability, and the naive way is, you know, vertical scaling. It's you throw more resources at the problem, you put more load on the system, and, you know, you essentially increase the cost of running the system from a hardware standpoint. The more challenging way of scaling is to use the system less, you know, essentially squeeze more performance out of what you've already got. And that's really what we're trying to do with Bitcoin, because by using it less, by using, you know, the main Bitcoin blockchain less, we decrease the amount of data and we decrease the amount of growth of the blockchain, because the blockchain never gets smaller, it only gets bigger. And if we are trying to extrapolate of, you know, what's the blockchain going to be like in 10, 20, 30 years, you know, if we really want to build a system that becomes a world reserve financial system that is mainstream and can be used by anyone, you know, we want this to be something that is going to continue to function for generations.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I was hesitant to say that the number of exchange to exchange transactions was like 50%. I said that in another interview and the guest said, no way, it's not that high, but I think you've confirmed that.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. There have been analyses and in fact, like when I worked at BitGo, which provides back-end wallet services for quite a few exchanges, we could see these flows. Mm. And so I have directly, you know, watched one exchange send, you know, even every few seconds, send a transaction that may go to multiple other exchanges. And it was extremely frustrating to watch because there was no way for them to know.
Yeah.
Because they're just sending it to, you know, this random address. They don't know who the addresses belong to. We were in a position where we could see that because we were facilitating all of these transactions and we knew which addresses belonged to certain other customers that were also exchanges. But it was something where even back in 2015, we were thinking, like, is there some way that we could set up, you know, payment channels or some way that we could, you know, privately inform users that are, you know, sending redundant transactions back and forth and back and forth so that we can get them to save money and not use all this blockchain data. And, you know, it wasn't until Lightning Network came out and became a thing that we realized that there would finally be a way for this efficiency to be gained in a way that didn't require people essentially exposing all of their address information to other exchanges.
Yeah, and so for people at home, hopefully that Liquid sidechain, the federated chain, a lot of those transactions are now going to go between those exchanges and not clog up the blockchain. And other little features, just like, is this transaction urgent? And you say, well, no, I only need it by the weekend or tomorrow when I wake up. There's so many ways, a bit like the power load on your home energy system, you know, do your washing in the day when your solar panels are on. That's the way we can make things more efficient. Lightning Network, you mentioned a few other applications. Anything that's taken your interest? I know there's some little sort of gaming apps and other things that are happening on the Lightning Network, but so much is possible. Are there any concepts that excite you?
So I like anything that is shoving a lot of technical complexities under the hood. A lot of applications of any of these technologies, the first things that tend to come out are usually gambling type stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, if you think about it, pretty much all of finance is gambling of some sort or another. But the things of like being able to directly incentivize people or pay them as they are doing other activities without necessarily even knowing what's going on under the hood is the most interesting to me. So, you know, in-game type of payments and items and stuff like that are interesting. Obviously, there's a huge gaming community, and gamers are generally used to the idea of like points or in-game virtual money. And you know, why have a different virtual monetary system for every game that you're playing if we can have a digital, you know, global platform? So that would be, you know, one potential application it's interesting, I think, applicable, and could actually get a decent amount of adoption.
Yeah, for those that don't know, you could still get Bitcoin for free in World of Warcraft, even up to 2013 or so, I think, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Simpler time. Let's change gears a bit and talk about the world of finance. A lot is changing at the moment. I think it's putting the problems under people's noses, whether or not most people are still watching their Netflix and they don't care. But I think this is probably the best opportunity we've had with people who got free time. You know, we're definitely seeing views and subscribers and that go up. So does that kind of excite you in some ways, that hopefully more people are going down the rabbit hole? And what aspects make you most bullish about Bitcoin? Is it, you know, the QEs, the negative rates, these bail-ins? Mm-hmm. You know, Lebanon is the latest country to set their banks on fire. Mm-hmm. To me, it's just this perfect storm of stars aligning. But yeah, I'd love to get your thoughts on all of that.
Yeah, you know, and the fact that this is all happening at the time of the, you know, once every 4 year halving event is also quite fortuitous. You know, I don't personally believe that the halving itself magically changes much with regard to like pricing and exchange rates, but I do think that it creates a buzz. It creates more interest, and it results in people looking into Bitcoin. And I think that in this case, what's going to happen is, back in 2017, Bitcoin really went mainstream not from a usage standpoint, but from a sort of word of mouth of I've heard of it type of standpoint. You know, mainstream media picked up on it, covered it quite a bit during the last mania phase. Mm. And then, you know, the bubble crashed, and I suspect the vast majority of people who had heard about it decided that Bitcoin probably died and, you know, the fad was over. And my hope is that this time around, we'll have another mainstream media cycle around the halving. Now, also coupled with new perspective of some of the monetary attributes of the system in the context of what's happening with central banks and governments all around the world due to the latest financial crisis. And this will result in a lot of people saying, wait a minute, I thought that Bitcoin thing died off, you know, years ago. How is it still around? Because really, this is what I think has happened to a lot of us. You know, even myself, very few of us who heard about Bitcoin the first time were immediately like, oh my God, this is so amazing. Drop everything with this Bitcoin thing. No, I mean, generally it takes multiple times of you keep hearing about it. Even for me, I'll never remember when the first time I heard about Bitcoin was, because I know that I dismissed it several times as, you know, some sort of online system that was going to get hacked. I figured everybody was going to lose their money. And it wasn't until probably the third or fourth time I kept hearing about it and realizing that the system was somehow continuing to operate that I actually looked into it, read the white paper, and started going down the rabbit hole. So I do believe that, you know, this has all of these events happening in conjunction with each other have a great opportunity to, you know, get a lot more people interested into actually looking at the system, and hopefully, you know, that will then result in some subset of them actually deciding to try it out.
I think that's one thing that isn't appreciated in Australia or the US, where we have pretty decent financial systems compared to these other countries. Everyone has their own story to tell. If you're in Lebanon at the moment, just being able to send money or get your hands on your own money, you know, custody makes Bitcoin interesting for you. You wouldn't even care if there's a 21 million limit. Just the fact that you can get your hands on your own money makes that valuable. Yeah. You know, you're coming at it from a technical angle, and I know technical people are going to challenge all these things, the double spend problem and whatnot, when they first read about it. Whereas for me, it was a light bulb moment as soon as I read about it, because I was a gold bug. And when you go, so we've got this gold, but now we're in this digital age and this is digital. So it just depends, and everyone has their own unique aspect of it, which people, I think they really forget about that sometimes.
Yeah, so that's actually why I stopped directly evangelizing Bitcoin to friends, family, and strangers. You know, for the first few years I was into it, I was going around, you know, trying to spread the word of Bitcoin. But eventually I realized that, you know, everyone has their own perspective, and I don't necessarily know what that is. And instead, it makes more sense just for me to put the information out there. You know, that's why I run the educational resources site. I just want to make it easy for people who are looking for information to find the information that's most relevant to them. And also to continue to build the system to make it more user-friendly, because then, you know, whatever someone's use case is, if it's friendly enough for them to make use of it and feel confident that they can use it without shooting themselves in the foot, then it doesn't matter why they would need it. It doesn't matter what properties they find most valuable. What's important is that they can use it, and that they don't have to feel like they need to, you know, keep their money with a custodian because they're not they're not confident that they can, you know, secure their own private keys. And that's why, you know, I've been full-time Bitcoin for over 5 years now, and I'm still working on a very low-level, simple problem of private key management. It's not sexy. It's not cutting edge like the Lightning Network, but I think it's a fundamental issue that we need to continue to improve if we want the system to get more and more adoption.
Yeah, I think the wallet space is one that probably hasn't had enough like venture investing, or it's still not there. I think we forget sometimes as technical people, when I set up a ledger for someone for the first time, like it is still really hard work. That's a big barrier to entry, and people end up on exchanges, keeping all their coins on those exchanges.
Yeah, this is, I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but I mean, I would say the vast majority of wallets, the vast majority of non-custodial wallets are just free open source software. And, you know, that's good in and of itself for a number of reasons, but also it means you're not going to get the same level of, you know, user experience and support because you don't have, you know, a paid team of people that are standing by to help out with user problems. It's all volunteer based.
Yeah.
On the other hand, a lot of the money and the technical development and the user friendliness is all happening in the custodial space, because those are the money makers, the exchanges. You know, they're basically printing money, you know, taking fees off of every trade that happens. And it's kind of unfortunate that, you know, the custodial providers are able to provide a better user experience for this and a number of other reasons. And so that is why it is particularly challenging for me and a small number of other entities to try to, you know, build for-profit but self-custody type of wallets.
Yeah, I just wonder if there's another way to provide some services and whatnot to get a bit of revenue, as you say, because I just think that would be it would be so amazing if you could just say, go to bitcoin.org, download this wallet. It's so easy to use. You'll love it. Set up this other thing, but we're still not quite there yet. But that's just because we're still early, I think, in the piece. The next question I had was about the financial behavior of governments and central banks. You spoke about that meme culture at the beginning. I haven't read that article, but I'm sure you mentioned the burr, the money printer that's going around at the moment. I just think that gets people to say, oh, yeah, governments are printing money. What's a central bank do? Are they printing money as well? Starts them on that question. Do you think they are starting to change their behavior? Because a lot of people were worried about the bail-ins after Cyprus, whereas I get the feeling now that that's not really a threat because governments and the Fed come out and say, we're going to print unlimited amount of money. They go on, I think it was Nightly News in the US, and say, withdraw all you want. We're going to keep printing. So do you think we're already getting to the point where Bitcoin is making people, financial people, change their behavior?
Yeah, and I was actually just talking to someone about this recently because there have been, I think, a few European countries that have like started enacting negative interest rates. And I think, that type of stuff is even better for Bitcoin because it's more obvious, right? It's obvious when the balance in your bank account starts going down. And so that is a great incentive for people to start looking for other places to park their money. I remember now. I was discussing stablecoins and Tether with someone, and we were discussing why is there so much demand for stablecoins? And this was actually one of the things was that if someone doesn't care about Bitcoin and doesn't want to expose themselves to the volatility, but they want to escape from negative interest rates, then going into a stable coin is one way to do that because you at least get to hold your own money, and it's also it's going to be directly pegged to dollar or some other fiat value. But then if you're starting to talk about, well, the money printing and inflation, that is a lot less obvious, right? It's I would say one of the most
least understood, yeah.
well it's to me it's one of the most insidious forms of taxation because it is very difficult to quantify and very difficult for people to even notice. If we're talking about your tax on your salary or on your property or on your purchases, like these taxes are fairly obvious. You know the tax that you're paying because you see the numbers in the bill somewhere. But what is the tax that you're paying on the devaluation of your money? Even then, you might be told by certain government agencies that the inflation rate is X or Y, but it's very hard to validate that.
100%.
And the methods that they use for those figures are questionable in many cases. So, that means it's less, I think it's less of an incentive for people, or at least at the very least, it means that the people who start looking into Bitcoin because of this are going to have to be more sophisticated. People who have more time and more resources to even think about this type of problem. Whereas, most people are just worried about their next paycheck, paying their bills, keeping food on the table. Those people are less likely to be in a position where they're able to think about these more abstract, less obvious issues.
Yeah, that was. We've done a lot of videos about this, about the stealth tax of inflation and whatnot. But once that penny drops, as you say, with the negative interest rates, that really is a game changer. It's only another 25 basis point cut that central banks have done hundreds of times around the world. But once we have them in the US and in Australia, where we haven't quite got there yet, I really think that's the last penny to drop. And all of a sudden, it's the currency wars everywhere. Let's go to this better option. Now, when all this happens, it's going to become obvious to people and governments that Bitcoin is the better currency. They're going to start to attack it more. we're already sort of seeing this path to maybe a digital identity and central bank digital currencies where they can monitor everything. How do you see that playing out? You know, can Trump come out and say, I'm going to ban Bitcoin? Is that irrelevant because it's going to be adopted in 100 other countries by then? What do you think about all that?
So the biggest reason why I'm not as worried about major governments, like first world country governments, trying to ban Bitcoin is actually because I believe at this point that there are too many rich and powerful people who own Bitcoin. And I think in many cases, politicians are some of those people. But even outside of the politicians, I think, you know, a lot of capitalists and even Wall Street folks and even people that work at banks who understand this, they're already into Bitcoin because they understand, you know, the hedge that it gives them as protection against some of the flaws in the existing system. And so I think, you know, one of the amazing things about Bitcoin is just the incentive alignment and how well it seems to align incentives to protect itself. I think I saw a statistic earlier today that said that you know, Bitcoin spends its entire budget as a system on defense. And if you compare that to military budgets, it would be the like 41st largest country in terms of like defense spending. And that's, you know, just from like a proof of work standpoint. So it's pretty amazing how robust the system is, and the fact that it incentivizes people by creating a neutral system that they know can't be pulled out from under them, that even the people who are in positions of power to pull the rug out from the rest of us, you know, via legal avenues or applications of use of force by nation states to try to pressure various people into doing things, even those people are incentivized to take advantage of Bitcoin and protect themselves by holding it and by you know, not wanting to try to make Bitcoin illegal.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting answer, and that might upset the, you know, some of the cypherpunks who don't want rich white guys in America to be the ones that are sticking up for Bitcoin in some ways. Do you get what I mean there? Versus, you know, this fully decentralized, all the little guys in the world that need it the most have it, versus that end of town sticking up for Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would think that, you know, in general, the cypherpunk ethos is, you know, you create software and you distribute it widely enough that it cannot be destroyed because it is information. You know, as we can digitize more and more things, we can then make them more defensible. And I think it's funny, when we talk about security, you know, of like wallets, for example, then the ultimate attacker in any wallet security scenario and any threat model is, of course, the nation state. That is like the most powerful force that exists. And so people who take things to the extreme say, okay, is this particular setup secure against a nation state attacker? And in many cases, we can say, well, when it comes to cybersecurity and securing private keys, for example, you can achieve a level of security against a nation state attacker because now you have the ability to distribute your private key material across jurisdictional boundaries and essentially put your keys in different countries that don't cooperate with each other. And so then the logical pushback to that is, well, yeah, but the nation state could still come to your house and throw you in prison and essentially coerce you into, you know, going around and getting all your keys and whatever. And that's where I kind of say, well, this is really the final frontier, is that until we get to the point that we can digitize our consciousness, we won't be able to secure ourselves, our own bodies, against nation state attacks. So hopefully, you know, this is getting into like transhumanism and whatnot, but at some point, if we can, I believe, digitize ourselves, then we can finally leverage the asymmetric defenses that cryptography and math have enabled us to defend many of these other things against powerful adversaries that have far more resources than we do, but we're able to defend against them because of the nature of cryptography. So hopefully someday we'll be able to, you know, defend ourselves, our own consciousness, our own beings with the power of math, but who knows when that'll be.
Awesome. That wasn't a question on my list, but I do want to circle back to that. You mentioned mining, and it's funny that climate change was sort of being the narrative that was pushed and central banks were going to save us from climate change before they were going to save us from this virus. What are your thoughts on renewables? Should somewhere like Australia just start building solar panels and be mining Bitcoin to pay it off? And do you think Bitcoin can get to 100% renewable in the next few years?
You know, these are tricky questions because we're talking about distributed systems that no one controls. Like there's no way to even know what percentage of Bitcoin is run on renewables. All that we know is that the incentives encourage people to find the cheapest power. And the cheapest power is almost always going to be renewables. In some cases, it may be stranded power, like we have seen some folks that are, you know, burning off, you know, flared natural gas that otherwise would have just been burned off and released into the atmosphere rather than actually used.
Yeah, spare capacity. Yeah. When people say, you know, China's got the majority of hash power and mining pools and whatnot, do you think that that's sort of reached that point also in Moore's Law where we're going to see more competition? We've got big mining farms we know are setting up in the US. The microchip sort of stuff's becoming more competitive now. Do you think that that's at a great point where we're going to see more distribution in mining?
Yeah, you know, the problem with China, they have multiple advantages. They have pretty much all of the silicon fabrication. And also they have a ton of hydroelectric power, which I believe the rainy season is starting again. And essentially, you know, close to free power, like more power than you can possibly use, getting generated by all of their dams. So this is something that's going to, you know, require a lot of work. I mean, people are being innovative, right? Is like we said, we've essentially seen a new type of venture of people going out and trying to find excess energy. Like the incentives just didn't exist before Bitcoin for people to go find cheap power that may be stranded somewhere because there was nothing you could do with it. So, you know, who knows what ingenious type of solutions people may come up with. I mean, I was even aware of a facility in the United States that was essentially like burning old spare tires or something to generate power. And like they were already doing that to generate power, but then they realized that, hey, we could, instead of selling this power back to the grid, we could use it to mine Bitcoin, you know, because it's even more profitable to do that. So, you know, I'm not an energy expert by any means, so it's, for me, it's just it's fascinating to hear about all of these different use cases.
Oh, for sure. The last question I had before we'll get into some of the philosophical stuff you mentioned. One thing that I don't think he's touched on enough is the value of having that secure distributed network. And we've seen someone like Microsoft come along and say, well, let's piggyback our ID system off Bitcoin. And we've got other protocols that are sort of piggybacking into Bitcoin and whatnot as well. Do you think that that is something that, again, gives it value to different people, and we'll see more of that piggybacking?
Yeah. I've written about this extensively as well and have an entire section of my resources site dedicated to it. I refer to it as data anchoring, you know, essentially using the Bitcoin blockchain as an anchor because we know what its properties are. We know how secure it is against the data and the blockchain being rewritten. And so then the question becomes, well, if we want to gain some of these properties of like auditability and immutability for our own system, but we know that we can't simply shove all of our own data into the blockchain because it protects itself against that by making it expensive, then can we use this resource more efficiently? And generally the answer to that is, okay, we create our own system and then we use cryptography to essentially create, you know, Merkle trees, for example, that can be used to prove large amounts of data that exist in our system. Yeah. And then we just take like the very root of that Merkle tree and put that into the Bitcoin blockchain on a regular basis. And that is our anchoring point so that you can run Bitcoin, you can get the data that you validated on the Bitcoin blockchain, and then you can also run this other system, and then you can basically compare the data, make sure that nothing has been screwed with. At the very least, you know, getting a tamper-resistant fingerprint of like snapshots and whatever this other system is. Yeah. And of course, you can get more complicated than that, and that's how we end up with things like the various side chains or layer two networks with Lightning.
Yeah. One thing I did want to ask about the memes and the money printer again. We've seen, I think, China and Russia really accumulate gold fairly quietly over the past sort of decade, and there's this turning away from the US dollar narrative. Do you think that if you're a struggling country, you've got a money printer, you've got nothing to lose by starting to buy Bitcoin secretly? Do you think that could already be happening? Would you do that? Is it going to happen soon once these currency wars heat up? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've speculated about that for a number of years. You know, once again, you look at the system, you look at the incentives. It, I think, makes complete sense for certain nation states, especially the smaller ones, to consider decoupling themselves from a, you know, petrodollar based system. And I think it was actually several years ago I was saying that I expected it wouldn't be too many more years before we saw some tiny micronation somewhere essentially declare Bitcoin to be their official currency. I mean, I know we've had like Liberland or, you know, one of these other like libertarian states do that, but you know, I'm not sure that really counts. I think that it will only be a matter of time before we see like maybe some small island nation, for example, go this route.
We tried to do it in Tasmania in 2013. We got a few ATMs and then Bitcoin went into a 2-year bear market and it didn't take off.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's go back to philosophy. So, guys, that's probably it for the technical and Bitcoin discussion. If you don't like thinking about consciousness, then you might want to tune out now. But, yeah, something that I love thinking about, got into meditation a few years ago. Once you start to learn about how DNA works and how you can store data on DNA, and the more you learn about computers, I just think it's makes me think that maybe we're in that simulation or any, either way you look at it, it is just so fascinating. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, that's a huge question.
The short version. You know,
how do we know, you know, what is real? Is the universe a hologram, et cetera? I try not to think about it too much. You know, it can lead to existential crisis, right? I like focusing on smaller problems that I feel like I can actually have an impact on. I mean, for me, the like accelerating rate of technical change point where I can't even keep up with everything that is changing, and you know, what does that mean with regard to humanity? You know, how do we continue to operate as a society? Like there's so many implications that you can't even possibly predict. I mean, that's how we end up with these like Black Mirror type situations, right? Of like dystopias. people getting trapped inside of simulations or whatever. I mean, I am like a virtual reality enthusiast. So I spend at least a few hours a week in virtual reality. And, you know, if I try to project where the technological trends are going to take us, you know, it's probably only a matter of years before we get to the point where you have like fully immersive virtual reality that is almost indistinguishable from the real world. I mean, I think that will basically require us to have like human computer brain interface type situation. But I mean, I don't think there's any fundamental reason why that can't be achievable if we consider the brain to just be an organic machine that we don't fully understand yet.
I completely agree. It's just ones and zeros. It's just neurons firing on or off. And there's some interesting work by Stuart Hameroff. I'm not sure if you've heard of him. He's an anaesthetist. So he was really trying to work out, well, why do these chemical molecules make us conscious or unconscious? And he drilled down into some very interesting work, if anyone's interested in that. Sometimes I do like to think about it because it puts things in perspective about how, I guess, small and insignificant and unknown we are in the universe when you've had a stressful day.
Yeah, so I did. I recently read the I Am Bob series. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but essentially, this is a science fiction series where it's a computer scientist, startup entrepreneur guy who essentially subscribed himself to a cryogenic service. This is something that I found a number of people in the Bitcoin space are also into. I mean, Hal Finney, for example, yeah. We know he's preserved. So this guy, he gets hit by a truck and then he wakes up a few hundred years later, except he doesn't wake up in a body. He has actually been digitized and he now exists inside of a computer system that he controls. And it starts to raise a lot of philosophical questions of, you know, what is consciousness, especially what happens if we can digitize our consciousness? What are the implications of that? What happens if you can then clone an infinite number of yourself and distribute it? And essentially this whole series is a result of him exploring the stars and essentially replicating himself and becoming this digital explorer where he's able to travel, you know, the enormous distances across the universe because he just puts himself to sleep, you know, for hundreds or thousands of years and wakes up wherever his destination is. And just fascinating things to think about. I've read a few other similar type of books like that. And I mean, if we're going down the route of, you know, what does it mean to become effectively immortal? That could potentially be a very boring thing unless we also have the ability to explore the infinite universe. Right. and so then there's also this question of, you know, I guess the heat death of the universe. If we do become immortal, then can we escape that? Would we somehow be able to escape into alternate dimensions, into other, you know, dimensions that have not yet died their own heat death? And this is a fun thought experiment that you could spend quite a bit of time talking about.
Absolutely. And I think we've probably stretched people's imaginations there after an hour of talking about Bitcoin as well. So great place to finish. That's been fantastic, Jamison. I'm going to put all the links to follow your work and your website and Casa down below. Any final thoughts for people?
Ooh, we've covered so much. but no, I mean, in general, each of these topics that we've talked about have a nearly endless depth to them, right? And we as humans, you know, our greatest limitation, I think, is time. And the hardest thing that you have to figure out is, you know, how are you going to prioritize your time Are you going to go super deep into one topic, or are you going to go more shallow and try to get a real breadth of different topics that you're interested in? And I think, you know, for me, at least, spending the past number of years going super deep into the Bitcoin rabbit hole has been particularly rewarding. But the amazing thing about the current state of our world is that, you know, we have the entire sum of human knowledge at our fingertips. And so I'll probably screw up the however I've seen it worded, but it's like we're at a point in time right now where we're too late to be explorers of the world. Like, the Earth has been pretty much well explored, except maybe for a few places, you know, in
oceans,
the Mariana Trench or whatever. But we're too early to explore the universe. Like, we don't have the technology to escape the gravity well very easily at this point. Right now, I think the real frontier of exploration is just in human knowledge and in, you know, thinking through what all the possibilities and implications are of technology and society. And so I think that neatly kind of summarizes a lot of the different things that we've talked about today.
I'm going to try and pick a crafty title out of that last quote, I think, Jamison. So that's been awesome, mate. I really appreciate your time. I hope you've enjoyed it too, and guys at home. And yeah, we'll have to do this again in the future.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys.